Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. On today's show, musician and strategic business consultant Bob Caporali explores the connections between composing music and composing successful business strategies. Kind of an interesting take on how to put together strategy. We end today's show with a co-founder of Talent Strategy Partners, Carol Vallone Mitchell, who takes an innovative, sometimes controversial approach to show how women can break through the brick wall of the B word. But first, regardless of the type of work you do or business you're in, we all have customers on some level. And branding expert Zane Raj joins us to share insights into creating brand rituals that create customers for life. He's known as a visionary leader, business accelerator, and industry futurist. He combines innovation, and creativity to create new business models for the future. And he's the chairman and CEO of Shapiro and Raj, an independent research and insights company, and has been featured on numerous national media shows, including CNN, The Wall Street Journal, Business Week, Fast Company, and more. And he has a new book out. I just mentioned the title of it. It's Brand Rituals. And we're going to bring that conversation to you right now. And we begin this segment with Zane's response to me asking him the premise of his book. And I find it really interesting how companies do create brand rituals, because it does really create that connection between you, whether you're an individual service provider, whether you're an employee, or whether you have a major company. It does create that connection between you and your customer. And so the full title of the book is called Brand Rituals: How Successful Brands Bond with Customers for Life. And we'll bring that to you right now. So let's talk about what you mean by brand ritual. And you give an example in the book of drinking coffee versus drinking Starbucks. So share that with us if you would, too, because I think it explains it really well.
Yeah, and I think you know, there are three ways people operate in their world, right? There are things that we do by habit. There are things that actually become routine that we kind of, forget how they happen, but they're just kind of things that we continue doing. And then there is what I call a ritual, which is where we go. And for me, it actually starts and ends with, why I love Starbucks. Because at Starbucks, not only do I get the ability to have the coffee that I love, that tastes perfectly for me, but I can actually customize it and create it the way I want. And I do it with three packets of brown sugar, a little half and half. I always have to have a double cupped and all organized. And then my cap has to go up on the exact opposite side of the seam, where the opening on the cap is aligned with the logo all the way. Right? So that to me is, it not only gives me what I want, but allows me to customize it and create it, but it also happens in an environment where the experience is consistent and allows my day to feel different. And I've said this, if I don't get my cup of Starbucks the right way every morning, then my day, I know, is going to go from good to indifferent, if not purely bad. So I make a lot of decisions traveling, wherever I travel around the world, making sure I stay in hotels that have Starbucks, mm-hmm. or there's a Starbucks within a block anywhere around the world. Now, interestingly, if you're not as bonded with your coffee as I am, not with my coffee, but with Starbucks, because it's no longer coffee for me, it's Starbucks, then you would basically, as part of the routine, you would stop at a whatever coffee shop that showed up on your way to, pick up the coffee. You could get coffee from McDonald's, it'd be fine, or you'd get it from Dunkin' Donuts, it'd be fine, or even a Starbucks, right? And, you know, about 25 to 30% of people, you know, that have relationships with some of these brands, tend to be part of what we call the optional group, right?
Right.
Those are people who have a routine. They need their coffee, but they'll get their coffee from anywhere else. And then there are people for whom it's a habit. You know, they will go and get whatever coffee they want from the grocery store that's on sale, right? And then they'll make their cup in the morning. It's a habit. I wake up, I get my cup of coffee, I drink it while I get ready, and then I'm gone. And I'm done, and I don't care, and then I drink whatever coffee they serve at the office, and I do not have to go out of my way because that's just fuel of certain kind, and it doesn't really matter. It's like gas, right? It doesn't matter what gas station, it is gas. So to me, habits are the ones where a lot of brands tend to be. You know, they kind of have gotten commoditized because what they haven't done is created the kind of experiences that build that level of attachment and the depth of attachment that builds a brand relationship that's bonded. And because of that, you see so much promotion, you see so many kind of, you know, price-oriented ways that people make decisions. If this is on sale, I'm going to get it, versus I don't care if it's on sale, I don't care if it's cheap, I don't care if it's more convenient, I am still going to go out of my way to get my Starbucks, because without that, my day is not going to go well.
Right, right. And that's a great example. It illustrates it really well. And you say that, you know, there are four steps needed to create brand rituals. And I wonder if we can run through those really quickly. Getting the initial transaction is number one.
Yeah, so get the initial transaction, right? I mean, that's the easiest one. That's how you get a lot of people to come into your franchise. But then the hard work starts, right? So if I try you for the first time and you've given me the transaction, and if I like it, then you as a brand have the ability to take the transactional relationship and build it into more of an attraction, right? Now, you know, you try me again, you try me again, you try me again, and you are satisfied with that experience. And, you know, you like what you're getting. That attraction then is what gets you to starting to believe that this brand is actually giving me something a little bit different than everything else I've had before in this category. So in the cup of coffee, okay, you know what, this was different. I could have actually done it differently. I tried the, you know, I tried the Pike Place this time. I tried a cappuccino the next time. I'm getting a sense of it. So attraction is where a brand has to provide a lot of different kind of ways and means for the customer to find the different connection points that are going to make it more important, right? So once you get to the attraction stage, then the third stage, which is a very, very critical stage, is when you get connected with the brand.
Right.
Right. So this is now, you know, you're over the routine area and you're now starting to get into a place where you are going to look and see if you can see that, right? And so there are people, I mean, I was flying back from, you know, last night, and I'm at the airport and I could see there are people that are, you know, just beelining straight into the Starbucks, and then there are people who are standing and going, looking at, should I go to Starbucks or should I go to the McDonald's, right?
Right.
And at least they're making the decision. So connection is at the stage when people are almost ready to beeline for you as a brand, but, you know, are still kind of thinking about other, a few other options in there. Now, this is ironically the stage where most brands mess up, right? This is where they start taking that customer for granted, and that's when they, you know, lose them, right?
Yes.
I got this person, he's coming at me, I've built a connection, now let me ignore them and see if I can get more transactions, right?
Right.
And this is the worst stage to be. I mean, United Airlines has done that to me many times, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and airlines tend to do it consistently, even, you know, telco companies, right? Like Comcast, I buy a package for X amount of money, and then 3 days later, I see advertising saying that same package is now available for X minus 100. And when I call them, they go, I'm sorry, you know, you're already a customer.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but that's what happens with the connection, right? And that's where people fall back. But if you can get beyond the connection, and if you can treat your customer well and surprise them and find something that connects the two of you in terms of values, right? And values are not about the environment or, you know, any of those big things, but just as a brand, can you treat me with respect, right, so that I can trust you, and can you exhibit loyalty to me like I exhibit loyalty to you, and then you will land up, you know, creating a bond.
Yeah. And
I mean, it's been...
And customer, I mean, treating going after customer retention versus new customers is not really a new thing, but it seems we got away from it so much over the last 20 years. So are we really just coming back to the core basics here?
I think everything I talk about, and that's ironic, right? I mean, I was talking to a couple of people at a conference I was speaking at last week in London, and basically the point I made is everything that I write and everything that I practice over the last 30 years as I've helped brands big and small and global to kind of, you know, succeed is all based on one simple thing: common sense.
Yeah.
Unfortunate problem in business and in marketing, common sense is very uncommon because people are, you know, get excited about all of the nuances of the art and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, people are very simple, right? Treat me well, give me a great product for a great value, and I will stay with you.
Yeah. So I want to go back just to the fourth step of the, creating brand rituals, because I think this is, it's absolutely key where you talk about aligning on core values. You give a great example in there of Whole Foods and how Whole Foods makes its decisions based on those core values. I wonder if you'd share those with us, because I think it really paints a picture.
Yeah, and absolutely, right? So, values are how people build their deep personal relationships. I may be an acquaintance of yours, I may have a good connection with you, we may be good colleagues, even maybe good friends, but my deep relationships are all built when the two parties share some core values that are consistent. And I think there are brands like Whole Foods that I talk about that have had a consistent set of values that they've lived by, and not only have they lived by, but they practice diligently every day. And I think those values, which is we care about our community, we care about our environment, we care about our employees, we care about our customers, we care about, you know, all of the things that I, as a consumer of theirs and a customer of theirs, cares about as well, because those are the same things. I care about my community like they care because we're in the same community. They care about the employees. I'm glad they care because those employees are my neighbors or my relatives, right? Mm-hmm. They care about the customer, which is me. They care about the farms and places that they buy from. They serve good things at a good value. Those values connect with me because they are very consistent with my values, which is why I am willing to be their customer on a consistent basis, and I'm willing to trade off going to a more convenient Jewel, which is what we have here, or a more convenient, standard market, and an even more convenient Trader Joe's to drive another 20 minutes to go to Whole Foods because of that. And values are the things that most brands tend to forget. I mean, look at what happened with Volkswagen, right?
Oh, yeah. Really?
Exactly, right? I mean, think about it. People bought Volkswagen because of they thought they believed in great cars, right? Lower emission control, great performance, German engineering made affordable for you. And they lied.
Right.
And who wants to be in a deep, committed relationship with a liar?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I haven't heard much about how VW is handling that. Are they reaching out to customers? I mean, they seem to have been very quiet, really.
Yeah, I think VW is basically, they fired their CEO, right? He stepped down yesterday. They are, I think, right now still figuring out what to do about it. I mean, this is, when you get caught lying, right? I mean, the easiest thing they should be doing now is apologizing. But obviously, in the world that we live in, especially given the fact that they may have an $18-plus billion fine, they are trying to, be corporate about the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
The reality on this is, oh, my God, nobody likes a liar. And nobody likes a liar when you have the proof of that lie sitting in your garage, and then you're sitting in it and driving back and forth, for 2 to 3 hours a day. It is a nightmare.
So you share in the book five myths that you say we need to let go of right now. I want to look at the first one here. We can and should change the customer's mind, because I work in communications and I'm always hearing, okay, we have to impact behavior. We have to change the customer's mind. Why do you say we need to let go of that myth?
Well, I mean, the reason why you have to let go of the myth is, right, a customer's mind is made up and has been made up based on a series of experiences that they've had with the brand and with the category over years, right? And I talk about this as, you know, memory structures, right? The memory structures are nothing but neural pathways that have been kind of created and gouged in a customer's mind over time. So think about McDonald's has, you know, over time convinced me that all McDonald's is good for is good food at a good value quickly, right?
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day. And now, if McDonald's were to turn around and tell me that it's like a fantastic sit-down place with this, I'm never going to believe it.
And that was brand expert Zane Raj. His new book is called Brand Rituals, How Successful Brands Bond with Customers for Life. But if you're into any kind of corporate or commercial branding or building your own personal brand, it's definitely worth taking a look at. And you can find out more about Zane and the work he does at zaineraj.com, ZAINRAJ.com. And please stay tuned. We'll be joined next by composer and strategic consultant Bob Caparoli. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
You listen when your body says, I'm tired, or I'm hungry. What if your body said something else might be wrong? Gynecologic cancers, cervical, ovarian, and uterine cancers have symptoms, so pay attention. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen. Learn the symptoms. Get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. A message from HHS and CDC's Inside Knowledge Campaign.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, New York Times bestselling novelist of The Magic Circle, Catherine Neville, goes digital. Also, creative writing teacher Ken Murray talks about his debut Eulogy and how we stop bullying in the workplace with business wellness expert Andrew Foss. Join us every Monday at noon right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and listen to archive shows at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Get a grip on life with Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and Bob Caparoli is my next guest. He's the president of Sequent Learning Networks, a New York-based training and advisory firm specializing in product management, product marketing, and strategic planning. Earlier in his career, he held leadership and executive roles in engineering, marketing, product management, and general management for multi-billion dollar companies. And he's also an accomplished keyboardist, composer, and songwriter. He's written and produced over 100 independently released songs, albums, and soundtracks. And we actually, Eric just played you into the segment with some of Bob's composition there. His latest book is called Creative Strategy Generation, Using Passion and Creativity to Compose Business Strategies That Inspire Action and Growth. Bob Caparoli, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And it's great to have you here. And we're talking about one of my favorite subjects, creativity.
That's great.
And I've heard you say that those who know you well know that you're passionate about strategy and, of course, composing music. Sony Music Entertainment's VP of Marketing, Bill Richards, says this about your book. Bob Caporale encapsulates how the two worlds of business and music can provide the storytelling tools that shape a solid business strategy. And that's really where I want to focus our conversation today, on the storytelling tools. You say effective business strategies aren't developed, they're composed, just like a piece of music, art, or any other creative endeavor. So talk to us about how you put this book together and why you did it this way.
Sure. Well, first and foremost, you know, I guess inside, I'm still this kind of struggling composer, artist inside that's been trying to peek out through all my business career, right? So I think that's part of it. But, you know, through my business career, I've always seen every company I'm with and every company that I work with, they have this focus on saying we want to be more innovative, we want to be more creative. And there's this also this underlying problem of, you know, people within companies not always so enthralled to be working on the strategies or working on the business plans or things of that nature. And as I kind of went through this, I said, you know, what's the missing link here? Why aren't people enjoying this part of their jobs? And why are companies lacking this creative piece? And I started to realize that people are separating a creative process from this business process. And I think that's kind of a dangerous thing. So I've always been able to bridge that gap throughout my career, and very successfully. And so I wanted to share that with other people and enable them to do it as well.
Yeah, interesting. There's a lot of talk about composition in there. Yesterday, when I was preparing my notes, I like to go outdoors to do my notes. And so I'm sitting out in the rain, talking into my smartphone using Evernote. And I opened up a new note, and it didn't say, you know, write your note or take notes. It said, compose your notes.
Oh, really?
I thought it was kind of funny. But let's talk about business strategy and identify that first of all. And then I'd like to go into some of the storytelling, because if anybody works in a corporate structure for any length of time, they can't help but hear story, story, story. We have to tell our story. But so few people know what makes a good story. And so, but let's begin with strategy, because this is another word that's thrown around. And as you said, a lot of people don't enjoy doing it. But you have made it more fun in your book.
Yeah.
So you say strategy should answer three basic questions. What are those questions?
So really, it's, you know, in reality, it's probably four, but it's been through the ages, right? It's where have we been? Where are we now? Where are we going? And the fourth most critical question is, how are we going to get there? And so that's really the key of, you know, basic strategic theory. When you get into the core of the book, then I start talking a little bit more about, you know, what strategy is going to do for customers and companies and competitors and so forth. But I think the whole thing about strategy, that people confuse things over time with business, strategy is really just about, you know, having a goal or objective in mind, understanding what's in between you and that objective, and then coming up with a plan to get there. And that's a very, very creative process. But somehow in business, we've made it, let's just say, you know, kind of checking the boxes and maybe somewhat boring. And I think that's where people get a little bit stuck when they think about putting together a strategic plan. Maybe it's not as much fun as it really could be.
Right. And so where do you think most people go wrong in creating a strategy in the first place?
I think really they see it as kind of a fill-in-the-box type exercise. You know,
yeah.
Maybe many companies have strategic planning processes for their, you know, annual strategic plans and so forth at a product or portfolio level. And they ask product managers, market managers, to kind of fill in a template, you know, fill out these 10 slides exactly the way we say to do them. And it's really a fill-in-the-blanks exercise, and it removes this kind of creative thought process. And so I think, yeah, people can fill in the templates, but if they're not really thinking about what they want to do and why they want to do it, then it just becomes an exercise, and then nothing gets executed. And that's really where I see most companies go wrong, is that they really don't execute their strategies because, by and large, a lot of times they don't have them, you know?
Yeah. And so for people who aren't familiar with developing strategy or have struggled with it in the past, what comes first, your strategy or your story?
Well, I really believe that they go together very much. It's a little difficult to say, you know, which comes first or not. You know, I think about strategy starting with the baseline of what do you want to do? So, you know, what is it that you're trying to achieve? Then you have to understand all the different variables that are affecting that. So in business, it would usually be what your company wants, competitors, customers, the industry, the landscape, that type of thing. Once you have all of that together, now you can start putting together your story from that foundation, because what you've just introduced there, more or less, are the characters, right? Now you have to determine what is it that all of those characters are going to do and how they're going to ultimately achieve the goal that you set out. So I think you have to establish those characters and then start building your story from there, taking them through that traditional dramatic arc that I like to call the strategic arc, but taking them through that arc so that you can take people on that journey with you. And that's really kind of, I think, the strategic story.
Well, let's take a look at that dramatic arc because, you know, as a writer, this is the first place that I started. You know, you're taught the Freytag arc. He was a German novelist and playwright. And as a commercial writer also, we use very similar structure. I mean, there's no getting around it. Even if you look at The Hero's Journey by Joseph Campbell, it's a circle, but it still follows that same kind of arc. So let's just talk about what that arc is and what it looks like.
Sure. So, you know, going back to Freytag's theorem, and you're right, it's been analyzed a million times, and I think a lot of different consultants and authors and so forth kind of changed the words a bit. But ultimately what it is that you have five basic pieces that you introduce what it is that, you know, your characters and so forth, then you take them on some journey that starts with a rise in the action, comes to some climax, then you start to follow the action working towards some resolution of the original problem that you set up. So this is the traditional storytelling arc. And if you look at any great story throughout history, they all follow this arc to some extent. And if they don't follow this arc, well, then they have a lot of trouble capturing your interest, because if you don't introduce characters that go through some level of action, build some tension that you care about resolving, then there's really no story to tell. And in strategy, it's exactly the same thing. You're introducing characters, you're creating some problem that you want to set up to solve, you have a climax, then you start to fall and resolve that problem. So it's really the same thing. If you don't have that, then you probably don't have a strategy.
So let's look at if I were, let's say I'm a small business, or, you know, I'm a manager who's been tasked with this, hey, get the strategy for your group done.
Yeah.
What kind of things go into telling, when we're telling story, we, as you said, we have to have that conflict or tension, because without it, it's just blah. So what kind of things might go into storytelling to make that tension or conflict?
So if we're talking specifically in business, generally a company has something that they want to do, and there's something getting in their way, right? So there's some problem that's being set up there. There's also customers involved. So usually customers have some need, and if you're trying to solve for that need, they have a problem, and you're trying to solve for that. So there's all these different conflicts, quote unquote, that are being set up in your strategic story if you're doing the right thing. Now, if you're doing the wrong thing, you just say, you know, I want to make money. Well, there's really not a whole lot of problem there. You know, you have to understand what's going to be involved in that. Is it going to be because you're going to be satisfying a customer need? Is there some competitor that's coming your way that you need to beat? All of those different things would set up these problem situations, and that's really how that story begins in business. When you resolve those problems, then you're going through that story arc, and the resolution would be the ending of your story.
Right. And you know, the principles are the same whether you're dealing with commercial writing or corporate writing or developing your strategy or even fiction writing. The principles are pretty much the same, as we've said. You share a great story in the book, and it always makes you cry, so I hope it doesn't make you cry relaying it to it, because I'm going to ask you to tell us what it is. It's Disney Pixar's animation Up. You say that's one of the best pieces of storytelling you've seen. Tell us why.
You know, it's been around for a while, so I guess I don't feel like I'm putting too much of a spoiler on it, but, you know, in just about 4 minutes, 5 minutes, that... The beginning of that movie, they are setting up this character, Carl, who has a wife who's passed away, and the whole idea behind this story that's being told in this little montage is that these two had these dreams, and throughout this little story, they're building what these dreams are. They wanted to go on these adventures, but life essentially got in the way. And it goes all the way through the fact that, you know, she eventually passes away, never really having been able to accomplish their dream. And I think it really works on so many levels. Number one, it follows that arc perfectly, right? You're setting up this problem situation, comes to a climax, you're resolving it, she dies in the end, and now that actually leads to another story. It kind of sets up another story. So it really sets up that arc perfectly. But the other thing that it does so well, and I think this is something that we forget in storytelling, is it connects. And when I think about storytelling and a lot of places where I see that it fails, you can tell a story and you can use the arc, but if you don't connect to the emotions of your audience, meaning that, you know, give them something that they could relate to and that they can feel what you're trying to feel or trying to make them feel, then the story will fall flat. And I think this is so brilliant because so many people have had this same dilemma, right, that we have all these dreams that we want to accomplish,
right,
and then we go through life and look back one day and say, oh, my God, what happened?
Where did all those years
fly? And I think because of that, now all of a sudden you can relate.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And there's another great story in the book, and this relates to music because you parallel that through the book. And that is the story of Kiss, the band Kiss. And, you know, we hear all of the time that we... You know, don't be like your competitor. Everybody does competitive analysis, even writers and musicians and artists, I'm sure. But everybody does that competitive analysis, but we don't want to end up like our competitors. We want to differentiate ourselves. We want to find our unique selling proposition or our value proposition. And you talk about how Kiss did this because... Basically, people could not get their music anywhere but from Kiss.
Yeah, and you know what I really, you know, I only mentioned them in very a very short part of the book at the very end, which is, you know, talking about production, because I try and take people through the different steps of strategy leading up to the final execution, which I call production, in line with kind of the music analogy. Mm-hmm. And what I talk about there very briefly is that, you know, you can differentiate in a lot of different steps in your strategy. And sometimes, even if many things are the same, you know, like in music, you'll use similar chord structures or even similar styles, there are places that you can differentiate. And one of those places is in how you execute your strategy. And what I think the brilliance of a band like Kiss, you know, at the time, they weren't writing music that was terribly different than other people of the time, but where they really differentiated was in the execution, right? In that stage show. They gave people a show like nothing else that they've ever seen. And so by differentiating in that way, they became one of the most popular bands, you know, ever. And I'm a big fan, in fact. But at the end of the day, it's about differentiating in some way. And you can do that in many different areas. So for business, maybe it's not the product, but it's in the way that you deliver the product or the way that you promote the product. There's a lot of different ways that you can differentiate in the minds of your customers.
Right. And so, you know, we hear a lot about creativity around the corporate world, but those of us who venture into it from time to time, there's not really a great deal of creativity, you know, day to day. I've heard you say that you don't believe creativity can be taught. Is that correct?
I do, to some extent. And you know, a lot of people ask me, can you teach creativity? And I say, you know, it's very difficult to teach people how to come up with new ideas. But what I do say, and I mark this statement, is that I believe that everyone has creativity and that you can teach people how to tap into what they don't think that they have but probably already do. And so rather than trying to teach step by step, you know, how to be creative, you know, what I try and do is say, you know, step by step, how can you tap into the creativity that you didn't know you had that's already there? So it's a subtle difference, but I think important, because a lot of times people are looking for that magic pill. You know, tell me exactly what to do, and then I'll do it, and then all of a sudden I'm creative. And instead what I try and say is, you know, you might have to go through a journey, and in that journey you're going to find your creativity, and that's really, I think, more important, because that's what's going to make it unique.
Yes, definitely. I think providing a great, safe environment helps enhance creativity amongst those who are a little afraid to step into it. You've written, I read, over 100 and actually released over 100 indie songs and soundtracks, etc. Let's talk about balance, because you work full time. You work full time, you write books, and you compose your own music. How do you balance all of that?
Yeah, let's talk about balance. I'm not sure.
I don't think it exists.
I tell you, it's true. I'll be very honest. You know, when I wrote the book and I said I want to do these music writing analogies and all these other things, I started to really, you know, question myself and say, well, who am I? You know, I'm not Kiss, right? I haven't written hit songs and things like that. But I think the position that I tried to write the book from is the position that I think many people in the business world are in. You know, I went and dedicated my career to really, you know, to growing this strategic side of the business. Now I'm doing training and consulting. Very happy, and I love my job. I'm very fulfilled. But I always wanted to do this music side, and I couldn't necessarily dedicate myself 100% of the time to that all the time. So I continued to do that on the side and amass whatever portfolio of music that I could. And today you can release so much independently, so it's wonderful. And so I kept both sides of that and married them where I can. And I really want business people to do that same thing. You know, if you're in business, you can bring your hobbies and your joys into your business, and it'll be so much more fulfilling if you can create those links. That's what I did. And by finding those links, I really think I was much more successful in business. And again, that's what I'm trying to capture in the book and share that a little bit.
Yeah, I think you succeeded. And you say yourself, if we expect to see all of the strategic rules thrown out, forget it, because you do include some of those. But the president and CEO of the Center for Performing Arts says, Bob Caporelli's creative strategy generation reminds us that we are first and foremost creative beings. Bob, a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
You know, I think that the most important thought that I'd like to leave people with is that so many people think of themselves as either creative or non-creative, and I think it's so dangerous, because everyone can be creative. You just have to let some of that in, and don't be afraid to bring what you love into your job and open up this creative part of yourself. And when you do that, your business is going to be so much more successful, and I think that's the most important message you can have.
Yeah, I agree. And for those who just think of themselves as creative, they got to use that left brain too, if they want to make some money, I think.
That's exactly right. There's two sides to everything. Like you said, balance. And I think that's important for everyone to realize.
Yeah. Well, Bob Caporelli, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time today. Great book. I really enjoyed it. And I've marked it, and I'm going to go through it and read some more too.
Oh, great. I'm glad. That makes me happy. Thank you so much.
And you can find out more about Bob and the work he's doing with Creative Strategy Generation, using passion and creativity to compose business strategies that inspire action and growth, at composingstrategy.com, composingstrategy.com. All right, please stay with us. When we come back, we will be talking the B word, and we'll find out more about that when we come back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Mm-hmm. This is Martha Norwalk, every Sunday morning beginning at 9 a.m. Thanks in part to best practitioner Dr. Nels Rasmussen, we cover the world of animals. This week, October 25th, it's an encore presentation of Animal World. Tune in to hear Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon in Seattle work their magic with harmonic energy shifting for callers and their animal friends. You could even receive a healing just from listening. So be sure to join us for Martha Norwalk's Animal World Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
You listen when your body says, I'm tired, or I'm hungry. Are you listening? Would you listen if your body said, I have pain and pressure in my abdomen. I feel bloated for no good reason. Or, I get too full too fast. I'm spotting, but I've already gone through menopause. Or, I have to go to the bathroom more often and more urgently than usual. These can be signs of a gynecologic cancer, like cervical, ovarian, uterine, vaginal, and vulvar cancers. Symptoms aren't the same for everyone. If your body says something may be wrong, please listen, learn the symptoms, and get the inside knowledge about gynecologic cancers. Call 1-800-CDC-INFO. A message from the Inside Knowledge Campaign and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, New York Times bestselling novelist of The Magic Circle, Catherine Neville, goes digital. Also, creative writing teacher Ken Murray talks about his debut eulogy and how we stop bullying in the workplace with business wellness expert Andrew Foss. Join us every Monday at noon right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and listen to archive shows at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Ahead of the talk radio curve, naturally. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And Eric's playing us back into this segment with a little more of Bob Caporale's music. And you can find out more about him at the website I gave out earlier, composingstrategy.com. All right, I'm very pleased to have with us now Carol Vallone Mitchell. She's written a new book called Breaking Through Bitch, How Women Can Shatter Stereotypes and Lead Fearlessly. Let me tell you a little bit about Carol. She has a PhD. She co-founded Talent Strategy Partners, a talent management consulting firm in 2001. She's worked with Fortune 500 companies to identify and develop leaders who can build and nurture workplace culture and drive results. And she earned her doctorate in organizational behavior from the University of Pennsylvania, where she developed the Women's Leadership Blueprint, a behavioral profile of success, which we'll hear about today. She uses this expertise and her 20 years of leadership development as a go-to speaker for companies and professional associations. Carol Vallone Mitchell, welcome.
Thank you, Vicki.
Pleased to have you here. And I think it's about time we retired this darned B word.
You think?
Let's get over it.
Indeed.
It obviously is still very prevalent out there because and women are seen to be this way if they're fearless leaders. And it's your whole mission, I understand, to shatter these stereotypes. So talk to us a little bit about how you became engaged in this kind of work and why you wrote this book.
Well, it started very early on. I was a scientist in the beginning of my career, and I just watched women who had made it to senior level around me be seen in a very negative fashion. And if they weren't called the B word, they were at least seen as being, you know, not team players, harsh in some way. And I just thought, what does it take for a woman to be successful? Clearly it's different than what it takes for a man to be successful. And that's when, you know, I was doing my graduate work in organizational psychology, and I just got very interested in behavioral differences in leaders, looking at men and looking at women.
And so let's take a look at some of those differences, because, I mean, remember the 80s when, you know, think of TV and movies like the Baby Boom movie with Diane Keaton. You know, women were dressing like men, if you will. They used to put these little kerchiefs at the top of their blouse and wear these kind of harsh suits and stomp around.
Mm-hmm.
And so when did that kind of change?
You know, it really has evolved. In the 80s, and friends of mine who were just entering the workplace in an office kind of environment, they had those little ties and they dressed like men. And the confusion, though, is that, and you asked really, when did that change? I mean, I think that went right up into the early 90s. And I don't really know if there was a trigger, but more and more women were feeling that they wanted to bring themselves to work and they wanted to be authentic. So I think that you just started to see that breakthrough. You know, at least I became aware of it in, say, the middle 90s.
Mm-hmm. And yet today, I read that I saw a whole bunch of different numbers on this on the internet, but approximately 50% of women work, and yet only 5%, you say, are women CEOs in Fortune 500 companies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge disparity there. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that, you know, we've talked a lot about the glass ceiling, and what I think we're seeing is that at those middle levels, women will get so far, and then there seems to be this brick wall that right. it, you know, that I've sort of labeled with the B word, and as you advance and as you get into more senior levels, I think the issue then becomes you're entering this world that you have to assimilate in. So it's really at the executive levels, it's predominantly male, and you have to cross into this territory where they see you as part of them. And so I think that is really the turning point. When you are going into an executive level, there's a lot of pressure to sort of leave, you know, the group behind you, and then, you know, not break ranks and be, you know, be part of the team. But the trick is that, you know, you can't act like a man and be authentic. And so there's a whole issue around managing gender expectations.
Right. You have a great quote in the book, and I have to say, who'd want to act like a man, really? I mean, you know, we've all got our strengths and differences.
Right.
You say in the book, women must demonstrate leadership in a way that bridges the expectations we have of them as women and the expectations we have of leaders. So let's just take the first part of that. Women must demonstrate leadership in a way that bridges the expectations we have of them. Do we need to change our expectations?
I mean, as a society, I think that, you know, our gender roles, we are experiencing a greater breadth in what it, you know, what is a woman, what is a man, you know. But I think that really at the heart of it, there are still these gender differences, you know, feminine and masculine, that these characteristics are labeled that way. And yes, men do demonstrate some, quote, feminine characteristics, and women demonstrate some masculine characteristics. But I think the first step is to be able to step away from that and not say this is a feminine characteristic, therefore it has to be only demonstrated by women.
Right.
You know,
more it's a characteristic that actually works and gets results, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, and it's just, you know, over and over again. Of course, we're socialized in a way. Then there's some great work by Deborah Tannen on this, looking at how we're socialized as children and our way of communicating and what, you know, our way of playing. And I touched on this a little bit in the book, but, you know, for women, it's all about connecting relationships. You're not, whereas, you know, on the other side of the equation, boys play and they want to know, they're like, you know, who has a leg up, right? So there's sort of this competitive thing going on. Not to say women don't compete, but the focus is more on the long-term building of relationships, whereas for boys, the focus tends to be who's winning. So that's, you know, that's kind of the reality that that we have inside of us as we're moving forward. So it's just a lot to change.
Yeah, so let's look at some of the characteristics that do work. And you say these work for men and women.
Yes.
And, you know, many men could be benefiting. We have to be in danger. We're in danger of stereotyping men here, too.
Oh, but, I know. And, but, yeah, that's why it's so hard to have the conversation, right?
Well, we need to have the conversation.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, because I do think we need to retire the B word. Women have been in the workforce for many years right now. I was listening to a radio show on the way up, and they were talking about, should women, you know, because this is a big debate right now, should women be on the combat field in war? And, you know, some people say yes, they should. Some people say yes, with limitations. There was a soldier on there who'd done, I think, 3 tours of Iraq and Afghanistan, and he said absolutely not. And he brought up the sexual component. He said
right.
There's a lot of sexual tension when there's a couple of women around men. We posture differently. We get distracted. You talk in the book of a story about Sheryl Sandberg, who talks about how she was sexually attracted to somebody at work. How did she handle that? Because it does happen. It's never happened to me, but it does happen.
Right. Asking, she was attracted or the other person was?
Well, there was a story in the book about Sheryl Sandberg, and she talked about sexual tension in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I'm trying to decide whether the story you're thinking of was in my book or in her book.
No,
sorry,
it was out of her book, but you quoted it in your book.
Oh, yes, yes. She was really talking about the perception that people might have, and it was about her relationship with Larry Summers early in her career, and them working late in a hotel room because they were getting ready for a presentation. They had been traveling. They had a presentation the next day, and she was leaving his room at 3 a.m. And she was afraid to walk out the door in case somebody saw her in the hallway.
So, right. Which you
so
can imagine.
So it was really about the perception, but there certainly is the sexual tension issue that many people have brought up to me. And I didn't even ask about it. So just particularly in the case of having a relationship with somebody as a mentor, sponsor, however you want to
right.
think about it, but you've got somebody who's typically in a higher position of power, and then you as a woman, often that person is a male, you know, often everyone's heterosexual, so there is that natural tendency because people who mentor you, they're drawn to you. They want to support you. You have the same values they do. There's so many characteristics around that relationship that sound almost like a romantic relationship. So I think it's a hard dance to dance.
Right.
And the way women...